Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming out. It's a big night for poetry in Chicago. There's a lot of readings, so a lot of really, really good ones. My name's Ken Clark. I'm the director of the Poetry Center, and Poetry Center was organized 30-some years ago by a group of Chicago poets. Some of them are here tonight. The Poetry Center has, through its reading series, presented hundreds of readings by poets from all over the place for the people of Chicago. This is one of several events. The next reading is Franz Wright on November 30th. Broadsides are available in the back, one by Ron, which is running out and fresh off the letterpress, one by Ansem. And the artist, Richard Taransky, is here this evening as well. So hopefully we can get him to sign some of the broadsides in the back. Hala will lead a workshop tomorrow night. There's two seats left, so if you want to be in a poetry workshop with Ansem, then there is that chance. And then Franz will lead a workshop on the 29th. So that's some of the commercials for the reading series. In addition to the reading series, the Poetry Center operates Hands on Stanzas. It's a poetry outreach program that pays Chicago poets to teach in the public schools during long-term 20-week residencies over the school year. They'll reach 3,500 kids this year, the same kids each week, 3,500 a week for 20 weeks, teaching them the basics of reading, discussing, writing, and then presenting poetry. In the last 4 years, about 1,100 kids have been in the direct workshops, and then those kids have reached out to their entire schools through school-wide poetry projects. We try to turn every school we're in into a little poetry center. And the last time Ron was here, he led a workshop for our poets, so it's exciting stuff. I want to recognize the Poetry Center's members, the volunteers, and also the staff, Shirley and Michelle Taransky, who happens to be the daughter of Richard Taransky, who's the artist for the broadside tonight. And then also Erica, who's in the back. She's our intern. And then the way that we do all this is through a variety of work that includes a lot of fundraising. One of our allies is the School of the Art Institute. They let us use this ballroom as the place for our readings, and they also donate office space for the staff and our interns. Financial support comes from Target and the Lannan Foundation, the Illinois Arts Council, Poetry Center members, very important, the Lloyd A. Fry Foundation, Polk Brothers Foundation, the Henrietta Lang Burke Fund, the Boeing Company, Chicago Community Trust, the MacArthur Fund for Arts and Cultures at the Richard A. Driehaus Foundation, the Northern Trust Centennial Fund of the Community Trust, the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation, Bank One, Elizabeth F. Cheney Foundation, Kraft, LaSalle Bank, the Seabury Foundation, and several others. I like to list those off because those people are actually giving money for poetry to happen at the Poetry Center. So that's it for commercials. Poet Michael Ananias is a longtime advocate and supporter of the Poetry Center. He taught at Illinois University for 35 years. He's a former editor of Tri-Quarterly and Swallow Press. His recent collection of poems is titled In Natural Light, and he will introduce tonight's poets. Michael?
This is a great evening and a particular pleasure for me. But for all of us to think that this poetry reading reaches from Helsinki to Tulsa. There's a Broadway song in there someplace. Anyway, it's a great delight. We're going to introduce Ansem first. And I think I could give a list of publications which would take all the time I deserve to have up here. Instead, I think you should take note of the new and selected poems in the back of the room, which is quite a wonderful book. But instead of doing that, I'm just going to talk a little bit about affection and my own attachment to Ansem's poetry. There are poets you read because they confirm for you your own suspicions about yourself and poetry, and then there are poets you read to find out what the unexpected possibilities of language can be. And Ansem is one of those poets. Sorrentino said once about Creeley that Creeley taught him that you didn't have to approach things dead on, you could take them at an angle. And I thought about Ansem in that same sense of the oblique, the angle that language can take, sometimes out of sheer invention, sometimes out of co-opting what language does and moving obliquely along an edge that, to use his language, deals with the possible attractions of experience, but also matters of spirit and mythology, which in Anselm's work seem to come as naturally as anything. A name drop. You got to do that yesterday. I can do it today. I was talking to Nicanor Parra once, and I said, "What poets do you read in English?" He said, "Anselm Hallam." I said, "Why Hallam?" He said, "He treats language as though it were a gift." Well, Anselm Hallam is a great gift, and it's wonderful to have him here. With great poets, it's often better to quote than describe, so this bit of Anselm Hallam I carry around in my head from a poem called Art and Literature, about 1976. "My hat blows off the planet, dinner is in doubt." Well, dinner may be in doubt, but poetry is not. Anselm Hallam.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Ken. Thanks, everybody. Yeah, it's nice to know that Don Nicanor said that. I'm sure he reads some other English poets, English language poets. He's still with us. I think he's 85. Well, alive and well in Chile. I thought I'd start out by reading, I'll read mostly recent things here. Now, reading a few from a book called Rue Wilson. That's Rue as in French for street, R-U-E, Rue Wilson, Monday, which was written during a six-month stay in a small town in France in a writer's retreat, or artist and writer's retreat place that in the 19th century had also been artist retreat. Among them, Robert Louis Stevenson, English author, who in fact met his American wife, Fanny, there. So he ghosts sort of through these poems here and there, mostly referred to as Cousin Louis, because he came there. The reason he came there was that his cousin, Richard, was a painter and stayed there. And it proceeds its short increments. Beautiful thoughts. Beware of those who write to write beautiful thoughts. Upper limit, poet as brain in jar. Lower limit, poet as hectoring, moralistic asshole. Prefer the difficile, the delicately unstable, sealed and farouche, or gamesome pasquinade. But faced with such stirring, Mr. Intellectual Rigor marches back in, a staunchly secular sort of guy. Deep bits of sky begin to beat, wave summons to water. Bird is also just bird, said Dragonfly. But now there's a kind of drone, card in wrong slot. Bits of rough bark fall off trunk. These have footnotes, but I won't read all of those. I'll read some of them. That one I don't think really needs them. Gates, waterfalls, shifting horizons, plastic halberds, gentle fugitives. Una Beatrice on the ramparts of Carcassonne, in black miniskirt, more like Juliette Greco. Is she thinking of Raymond, the Cossar, Count of Toulouse? Fat chance she's gazing at sudden flock of paragliders in the sky, while the guide drones on and I think of fictitious employment by no means uncommon in France. He means government employment, fictitious government employment, but then government is fictitious too, as are the governed much of the time. Look for yourself in this pebble or pencil. Faintly flapping horizon of symbolist project, fused in cosmic azure, French pronunciation. Brief clouds merge and pass away, away into other vapors. Hyperbole from my memoir, triumphantly you rise today, grimoire. Ah, Stéphane Mallarmé, after a lifetime in classroom hell, translated Poe, but his students never learned any English. Neither did two of mine who attempted yet another translation of the Dystos, enshrined now in exalted lacquer box. We have to think French to read him. The lacquer box is a reference to Mallarmé's sharing Whistler's and Manet's love of Japanese art and artifacts. Waiting. Waiting for a loved one to return. Waiting for air raid sirens. Waiting as in the old French popular song, J'attendrai. Waiting, repeating the word, boring as waiting can be. Bored again. Nice anti-fundamentalist bumper sticker. And so time curls slowly around yet another bad anecdote. Blue hour, a look both frightened and brave. Yes, we can make things fall from the sky. Post-USA poets will ponder our programming and its consequences in the third millennium. Remote ends are a dream, said Alex, the one with heart in his name. That's a reference to Alexander Herzen, 1812 through 70, the Russian revolutionary leader and writer. Herz being German for heart. Wonderful writer. Returns, twilight summoned the master of dolorous speak. Now click here for dazzling version of nothing. But hearts moted by joyful pessimism sing with watery creatures sleep in leaky boats. Curtains on eyelids, dark laughter heard falling out over ivy with music cut to tracer bullets. Earth trembles under mysterious house on closed eyes road. Closed form is coffin, Pentagon is closed form. Expensive explosives engulfed by fracturing stone. Punctuate swarm of questions, it's all opaque. Watch the cerebral thermometer disintegrate. Globules of mercury, angle of hand on keyboard. Sparks of silence and nonsense fly up the chimney. Longing, a kind of loitering with no intent. And one more for them from this little book. Now back to states, whose president is bullied by the viciously lame. Cultural demons embodied in ignorant powerheads, sadly including his own, into facing sex mores inquisition. Unable to tell them, that, you sanctimonious slugs, is none of your business. As the Scot poet psychologist who died playing tennis once told innocent questioner plagued by internal rakshasas, just tell them to fuck off. Watch out in the lands of fanatical hypocrites, smiling, unsmiling, they radiate spite. When this you read, liable you become to conspiracy charges filed with their fiendish gaudy. Rakshasas, hungry demons in Hindu and Buddhist parlance. And then I'd like to read some from my next book called Guests of Space, which I'll read the title section. And it sort of has to do with people who died. Guten Tag, Herr Schopenhauer. Bonjour, Monsieur Siovan. Good morning, Mr. Swift. How are you, Mr. Burroughs? Once again, history, the unstoppable, proves you right. Species no better than smart rat, maybe not even as smart. Evolutionary leap? My foot. My foot in 3-foot hole, but let all peaceful mutants leap for spring. Kalu Calais while they still may. Watch it. Don't twist that ankle. Don't step into that 3-foot hole. And wisdom has not come against wisdom as such. Oh, it is apt to give a gopher tantrums, anecdotal befuddlement, infinite terminators. Toujours a mountain eased the previous you. Should it feel easier writing? I don't think so. No. Once you've said something, you can't unsay it. Once you haven't said anything, it remains unsaid. And anything you can't say, well, it's unsayable. All right, now that we got that out of the way, we need some particulars. But where did I put them? Where are my particulars? Here they are, sir. Oh, thanks. Today's mail, 3 books of poems, 1 cigar catalog. The poems look great, so does the catalog. But aren't you trying to quit? Mel Torme died. Charismatic didn't make it today, the 5th of June, 1999. And in a restaurant called the Europa 93, warlords consult on a respite from murder and mayhem. To the memory of Hannes Hollow, dates 1959-1999. Fought the hungry ghosts here on earth. What is man? Asked the king. Alcuin's reply, a guest of space. And time, yes, time. The past lies before us. The future comes up from behind. Walking on Primrose Hill or Isle of Wight beaches, Iowa City streets, scrambling up snow-covered deer track to Doc Holliday's grave in Glenwood Springs. His helmet now shall make a hive for bees. He fought the hungry ghosts here on earth. Strong and resourceful on his best days, patient, kind, and presente, returning those with him to here and now. But just as we settle in with our Pepsi and popcorn, the end rolls up too soon, always too soon. Footnote, what is man, asked the king. The king is Pippin, son of Charlemagne, in the 9th century Common Era. And the line about his helmet now shall make a hive for bees is by George Peele from a poem called Polyhymnia. Here have I summed my size playing cards with the dead in a broke-down shack on the old memory banks. E'en though my thoughts like hounds pursue me through swift, speedy time, feathered with flying hours, but could have sat there for many more hours, listened to poet friends reading works by an absent friend whose work we love, in the name of Anna, the all-mazifold, the ever-living, the bringer of plurabilities, concretized, concertized, temporally minute progressions of action, swirling mists of the past. You have a lot of stuff here, you know? Yes. Now run on home. And, of course, it won't do. It won't do at all. Herzen again. Suffering inescapable, infallible knowledge neither attainable nor needed. Sound of swan's wings over the quarry ponds at Grey. Look up the departed Ceylon to some picture book Norway. And Mr. P, old Gaga cantor among the ruins of Europe, writes to his missus, where are they, where are they? Old genius snows falling on his head, in his head. No, it won't do, it won't do at all. Private they are, the sums of grief, impossibly private. There probably is some intelligence at work here. Yes, but I don't want to know what it is. Elizabethans considered a nosebleed a symptom of love. But if the wind don't blow through it, it don't make it. And what if the personal prove as tiresome as the public? Mawkish messages to the dear departed? No, that is not given to you to do. Nor can you really get behind idealized forebears getting wiped out while attacking some barn. Did you say barn? In the glorious South or any other cardinal direction. And now this old cardinal, Universal Life Church, hums, Canae capilli me cum pedis, gray hairs are my chains. Against meaning, lunatic, real, possible in appearance, you work a line. Be like a larger logic to defy the dumbly trembling unities. Quotation fringe is blue. Yourself helps us from prose and down into an orange. Hail my effort, you people. Stand and deliver. But stubborn world is time and airy dung. Insists on legible distance, inhabited heaps, as Lacan points out. Never mind what, never mind, never mind, sing the old huddles. Persons bowed down with age or heavy wraps. And should I buy this Scientific American to see how the quest for immortality is going? Got the one on space exploration. Such incredible hardships ahead. Calling $29.99 in this old English, but we are just learning to walk And time is a voice goes a-roaming, just a chickadee in the rain. Greenhouse almost ready now. Oh, they too have their troubles. The beloved, intuitive, abstract, expressive painter, the ever-distracted, monkish poet, musing upon the Malevich square on Hitler's upper lip and the fact that questo does not mean quest. The human being talks, it talks and talks and talks, even to itself. So, hating speech, what was that about? No speak, no talk, no read, no write. Now, that sounds like the dead, except some of them do read themselves into our ears, day and night. When the slinger passed on, it left me restless, the way one was restless after a teenage rendezvous, driving somewhere fast with the windows rolled down. The slinger here refers to the poet Ed Dorn, who actually spent some years here in Chicago teaching for Northeastern University, as did Ted Berrigan after him. And the last two lines are a quote from driving somewhere fast with the windows rolled down. That's what my daughter Tamsin remembered. It was her memory of Edward Dorn from when she was 5 years old. And this one is another little memorial to another friend. Would that it were otherwise, otherwise spelt with a Y, W-Y-S-E. One eyebrow raised, Sir Thomas listens to his quill. Check Wyatt quote. Can't find. It's not a Wyatt quote. So what? It's you trying to sound like him. Oh, would that it were otherwise. Friends did not have to die. Andrei Voznesensky in Iowa. Tragedy of artists is artists have to die. Bye-bye, Fielding. Bye-bye, Falstaffian fun. Fielding does. I'll write a poem about nothing, absolutely nothing. Not about myself, or youth, or love, or any person. I'll write it riding along, half asleep in the sun, and then I'll send it to a friend. Signed, William of Aquitaine, 900 years ago. And ever since, we've raged in shirts red, black, and blue. We've raged, still do, in our dream rooms, asking the air mad questions about nothing. The Duke of Poitou, William's poem, can be found on page 7 of Paul Blackburn's Proenza, an anthology of troubadour poetry. For the shirts, see Ted Berrigan's The Sonnets. Equipped with human heart's dizzy gyroscope, in the yellow submarine we lived, oh my darlings, is it now all just imaging? No more imagining in the momentous events in small rooms hotel, the brain is? Don't remember the time I was born, don't want to remember the time I die. Old troll stands in secret memory garden, gazes at mirror globes, beloved faces. Through time they move as guests of space. Yes, that we are, he thinks. Remembers Alcuin's answer when Pippin, son of Carolus, asked him, what is man? And cousin Louis, you will always do wrong. You must try to get used to that, my son. My first computer, poor old workhorse machine, just an advanced version of the clay tablet. Archaic box, you still work, humming that hum I found so irritating 22 years ago. Used to say, this thing's no smarter than an amoeba, waiting for me to write a word and then another and another. But I shouldn't have said what I said just then, because only a few days later, it went from hum to loud groan and died. There's words, and there's hair, and hair, and hair. Would you know evocative if you saw it? Or have you not had the enigma reversal experience? What's that? What's that? They cringe and snarl. It has to do with the minutely sensational, say I, with what's little enough, but enough. And when you turn the radio on, and it is the right music, even when it introduces sadness, and one understands little of what's going on. And thus we woo our wit with gentle memoranda, birthday thoughts about mother long gone, and her madcap cocaine-addled sister, Aunt Karen, I never knew, her son, cousin Peter, ever wistful, but such a smile. Now gone, too, dusk road games, dust road fumes. Reality is wet today. How big is the mind? How could we avoid dissolving in our own private oceans, asks Randolph Healy, dear Irish poet. Beat, beat. It's a strange, strange world we live in, Captain Jack. And who was that, and why? Look up at the sky, bro. Look up at the sky. That was Look Up at the Sky, was Allen Ginsberg's recommendation for states of mild depression. He said, look up at the sky. All that 50s-style, wretchedly splendid, better living through chemistry, when people said things like, haven't I seen you somewhere before? Always worried about hitting exactly wrong note. Hence tall, strung-out conversations with hypothetically beautiful persons. Remember those? But now I'm pissed off at you, old sport. Even though you're dead, to my regret and possibly even yours, no longer hanging on to tatters of poetic mantle or moth-eaten, unacknowledged legislator's wig. Addressed to no one in particular. A composite, possibly even self-portrait.
This is like an opera house. Amazing.
You are not the Countess of Tripoli, and I am not dead yet, unlike Geoffrey Rudel. So now I can tell you about the most interesting metrics of the horse. To wit, the rack, the foxtrot, the amble. Four beat gates, with each beat evenly spaced, gliding and smooth in perfect cadence and rapid succession. The legs on either side move together, the hind leg striking the ground slightly before the foreleg. Vraiment, poetry can be so many more things than what people mostly believe it is. And there were years when nobody died. Countess of Tripoli and Geoffrey Rudel, quote from Blackburn's Provençal translations, Geoffrey Rudel fell in love with the Countess of Tripoli without ever having seen her. Because of his desire to see her, he took the cross and got put to sea. He took sick on board the vessel, and at Tripoli they thought he was dead and carried him to an inn. When this was known to the Countess, she came to him to his bed and took him in her arms, and then he died. On the 7th of June, 2004, Bix Beiderbecke would have been 100 years old, just like Karl Rakosi. Then still alive. Did Carl and I ever listen to Hector Berlioz? I do remember listening to the Symphonie Fantastique with Gregory Corso up in his little room with a view of London's Primrose Hill, where Sylvia Plath walked with her young. Time is a great teacher, said Hector Berlioz, but unfortunately it kills all his pupils. When you're feeling about as bad as your average English translation of Goethe, you must go see the Parrot of Penance, and he will say unto you, way around it, way around it. There's never been any way around it. So the ants made it to the cat food, but then you scrape them into the compost. One day we'll set out under solar sail to the systems of 50 new planets discovered this year. Who knows if we'll do any better than these ants, you think, then, and contemplate vast grids upon grids, shifting and twisting, clashing and gelling, flowing apart, exploding, shrinking to this little blob of cat food in the kitchen sink. Oh, it gives one the flesh of the hen, comme on dit en français. Cat disappears into bush. Comme on dit en français, as they say in French. That mouse, I'm sure was very dear. It came out of its little house in the compost pile, and our cat ate it. It is now part of the cat, who is also very dear. Muchos dolores in veterinarian's bills, due to his fight with another cat, who a while back intruded on his hunting ground, i.e. the compost pile. We hate that other cat. Well, we don't really. We're too nice to hate. But we sure wish he could be disarmed. On reading certain novels. Halfway through this family saga, I no longer care to keep track of who is who as they go on darting about and having conversations. Affirming our kinship with all that walk, fly, crawl on land or sea, that's what they're doing. That is all they're doing. It is enough. No matter what order they're doing it in, and who is whose nephew, uncle, mother, mistress, or niece. It's like a big treetop full of twittering birds. And I was so lucky to find my little branch long ago at quite some distance from the rest. Thank you.
The first piece of work I ever saw by Ron Padgett was in the book review section of about 1964 issue of the magazine Culture, which is spelled with a K and published by Lita Hornick. It was a series of line drawings in cartoon boxes, each the same, each holding a rhinoceros. Behind the rhinoceros is a flat plain, in the distance were some mountains. And the speech balloons over the rhinoceri, or rhinoceros, I think it was the same one in each square, but that's a hypothesis. Each of the rhinoceroses said, "I like this book." I've forgotten who it was by, actually. I remember the drawing very much. From that book review. You have to remember that the review section of Culture had reviews by Frank O'Hara and Leroy Jones and Gilbert Sorrentino. It was a remarkably interesting group of people with a sort of lively intelligence about coming on books, and there suddenly is this guy who's signed, I'd never met him, called Ron Padgett with rhinoceroses. Well, from that time to this, I've gotten used to being pleasantly surprised by the work of Ron Padgett, a lifetime of really wonderful poems and books of prose. There's a reprint of Great Balls of Fire. It's available in the back, which is an enormously interesting book. And the beginning of most of our reading of Padgett at any length, all the way through the Selected Poems, which is, I guess, a couple years ago, and recent poems, plus several very interesting books of prose, a memoir of Ted Berrigan called Ted, the just-published memoir of Joan Brainerd called Joe, and then a couple of collections of Ron's incidental prose pieces, writings on poetry, and a wonderful collection of incidental prose. All of these things are hugely interesting and surprising. I can't quite match the para, but I was in Germany speaking to one of those leftover Prussians, a Berlin prose writer named Bodo Morshäusen. And he said, "Do you know Ron Padgett?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Best poet in America." I said, "How do you know Ron Padgett?" "Bean spasms. Can't beat it." Well, that doesn't match para, but he doesn't believe me. He's still not believing this story, are you? It's a true story. He knows more, so is it, right? Anyway, the Padgett's poetry is always surprising, engaging. I tried to think of a way of characterizing him just to myself, and it is that I think Ron writes with enormous ease out of a sense of the sort of comic fluidity of what's going on around him, and with a great capacity for doing things that are technically astonishing in poetry that you don't quite notice until they slip past you. He wrote a book of forms a number of years ago and rescued that wonderful array of possibilities in language from the standard shut up and go to your room quality that books about forms had before. It's a pleasure to introduce Ron Padgett.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael. And thank you, Poetry Center, for having me, and especially for having me read with one of my all-time favorite poets, Anselm Hollow. That's not just podium flattery. I'm going to read first some poems from a book of mine called You Never Know. It's the most recent collection of poems of mine. And I read here a couple of years ago, and I read from the manuscript for this book just before it came out. And so now that the real book is here, I wanted to read just a couple of things from it that I didn't read before. The County Fair. The Holstein looks at us with big eyes, but with no expression in them. What images are flashing in its brain? The white goat walks over as if to ask a question, but it has no question to ask. There is no question mark in the goat world. The rabbit's pink eyes dilate when a hand draws near, but it does not move, and like a house shoe, it says nothing. The two holes in the top of the goose's beak are in search of something to get huffy about. The poor goose is angry and without real nostrils. The black and white feathers exploding from the head of the rooster shows that he is ready for war against the infidel. The piglet walks and trots around with white eyebrows. Hey, he likes the infidel. Bluebird. You can't expect the milk to be delivered to your house by a bluebird from the picture book you looked at the age of 4. He's much older now, can't carry those bottles neath his wing, can hardly even carry a tune with his faded beak that opens some nights to leak out a cry to the horrible God that created him. Now don't think I'm the bluebird or that you are. Let him get old on his own and die like a real bluebird that sat on a branch in a book, turned his head toward you, and radiated. This next poem mentions the poet Robert Creeley. It's kind of inspired by the poetry that Creeley wrote at one time that had sort of interestingly angular line breaks, which he read in a kind of halting way. This poem is called Bob Creeley Breakthrough. This is going well today. I mean, the fingers typing and the face smiling and the breath going in and out, like a nice girl on a date who for the first time removes her blouse, but your heart is pounding so hard you can't actually see anything except a mental image of Robert Creeley. Bob, go away. So I can see this girl and do whatever it is I'm supposed to do. Your line breaks are making it impossible. Frisky. The black and white terrier flexed his body in midair, turned and yelped. It was his birthday, and he was 2. Album. The mental pictures I have of my parents and grandparents and my childhood are beginning to break up into small fragments and get blown away from me into empty space. And the same wind is sucking me toward it ever so gently. So gently as to not even raise a hair on my head, though the truth is that there are very few of them to be raised. I'm starting to take the idea of death as the end of life somewhat harder than before. I used to wonder why people seem to think that life is tragic or sad. Isn't it also comic and funny? And beyond all that, isn't it amazing and marvelous? Yes, but only if you have it. And I am starting not to have it. The pictures are disintegrating, as if their molecules were saying, I've had enough, ready to go somewhere else and form a new configuration. They betray us, those molecules, We who have loved them, they treat us like dirt. The love cook. Let me cook you some dinner. Sit down, take off your shoes and socks, and in fact, the rest of your clothes. Have a daiquiri. Turn on some music and dance around the house, inside and out. Hell, it's night, and the neighbors are sleeping, those dolts, and the stars are shining bright, and I've got the burners lit for you, you hungry thing. And these are some things from manuscript, newer works. Hercules stood on the hillock and roared just because he was Hercules. The waves below crashed below the churning sky. It would have been Christmas, but it was too early in history. Therefore, no gifts for him. But he didn't need a gift. He was Hercules. An outline was always around him. In case he went away, there would be a drawing left. That's what we see now. If you want to hear him roar, listen. History lesson. I think that Geoffrey Chaucer did not move the way a modern person moves. He moved only 1 inch at a time in what we call stop action. Everyone in his day moved like that, so they could be shot into a tapestry, but also because time moved in short lurches and was slightly jagged and had fewer colors for them to be in. But that was good. Humanity has to take it one step at a time. Standoff with Frosty. Every time I sit down to do some serious work, my stomach tells me it's time to go downstairs and see what's in the fridge. But when I reach in there, an icy hand grabs my wrist and thrusts me away from the territory of the snowman. Yes, Frosty himself. He lives in there with a banjo and a carrot. He plays the banjo and thinks about the carrot. But it is a dull existence, and he is disgruntled. How can I make him happy? There is no way, for he can neither hear nor understand my words. I cannot reason with him, describe the Arctic nights that gave him life, nor lure his melancholy world away from him. He is stuck, and so am I. Thinking about the moon. As a child, I thought the moon existed only at night. There it was, in the dark sky. When I saw it in daytime, I knew it was the moon, but it wasn't the real one. It was that other one. The real moon had moonlight, silver and blue, and the full moon was so big it seemed close. But to what? I didn't know I was on Earth. This next poem mentions someone named Ted, who turns out to be the poet Ted Berrigan, and it also mentions the poet Kenneth Patchen, someone who people don't talk about much anymore, but maybe they will. This poem is called All in White. All in white my love went riding. Is that a misquotation? And if so, of whom? It's the kind of line that Ted loved back in 1960 because of its lilt and, in his mind, a kind of Irishness. Kenneth Patchen? What did I see in him that I don't now and still want to? A dark lilt and a slide through pain, both of which I wanted and didn't have. I had a light lilt and a moderate pain. Ted had a dark and light lilt and was fleeing from pain. I said, I don't have any pain. Ted said, yes, you do, ha-ha. The springtime was lovely, and out there, all in white, my love went riding. The Goldberg Variations. When I heard Glenn Gould talking on the radio today, his voice from long ago, I knew no matter how eccentric, how difficult, how crabby he might have been, I knew I'd trust whatever he had to say, and I did. So well structured his sentences were, and precise his words. And for a moment I felt regret I never knew him, though I don't think I could have talked all night on the phone with him, but then maybe I would have, especially when I was young enough to kill myself for art. This next poem is kind of, it's in little tiny pieces, so it doesn't, and it's called, oh my God, it's called Pikakerjoy Tushivko. I hold the door open for a frail, elderly woman. She looks surprised. I will never recover from having a mental flash of Jimmy Durante the moment I learned that Dante's real name was Durante. The more our public officials talk about integrity, the deeper burns their hypocrisy. Thinking up such a truism makes me feel contaminated. The French have a reputation for verbal exactitude, so why do they call a tuxedo a smoking? When I first looked in the mirror, I had always been there. Waiting for the light to change, a nice-looking young man in his 20s unwraps a candy bar and drops the wrapper a few feet from the trash basket. The American economic system, if anything so out of control can be called a system, requires ever more production and consumption, resulting in greater and greater destruction of the natural world and increasingly invasive attacks on the nervous system. This juggernaut knows how to go in one direction only. I am part of this system, being invested in it, mostly, I tell myself, to protect my wife from a future of penury. My first duty is to her, despite my mounting shame and disgust at the ruin that we, especially in the West, are wreaking upon the world. It's strange that these monumentally important, if obvious, ideas sometimes strike me as tedious, as if they were a minor annoyance. She walks in and asks, "What are you doing?" when she means something else. I have to call Ted Greenwald. For a writer, it's good to be angry all the time because then more people can like your work. On the last day of a stay in a distant city, I try to remain interested and busy, although I know I am just marking time until the hour of departure. I stand in the Luxembourg Garden, but I am not fully there. Now I notice that I have begun to do something similar in my life in general. On the verge of 60, I have started to mark time. Hey! Fiddlesticks. A secret homage. We refer to the decades of a century as the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, etc., even the teens. But why do I not know the name of the first decade of a century? Is it a blind spot particular to me? Fantasy and Fugue in A Minor. Morning ablutions used to sound like something that people did in the 19th century. Now I do them. Differences of race, national origin, religion, social level, wealth, gender, age, political ideology, philosophy, all these can be barriers to compassion. But what about intelligence? How many people of noticeably lower intelligence do you account among your true friends? It's almost midnight. No wonder it's late. I'm not sure what it means that when I learned to tie my own shoes at the late age of 6, I did so by myself, inventing a curious series of loops and moves that I still use 55 years later. When the footsteps in the hallway stop, a long shadow flows under the door. Then he moves on. In movies about Indians, there is never any evidence in the teepees or elsewhere in the village of a bathroom. So where did they... Shop name in Upper Manhattan. Explosions 2000. Men, women, and children. The miracle of existing and being able to say so and have drapes. Farrago. The day I was born, German saboteurs came ashore on the coast of Florida. Title, Whatever May Happen to Your Hair in a Song. Quote, by convention sweet, by convention bitter. by convention hot, by convention cold, by convention color, but in reality, atoms and void. Democritus. One day, looking at a painting by Matisse, I lost my back. Bernard Noël. The origin of the word turmoil is unknown. How many people alone in the privacy of their own homes have ever sung the national anthem? Probably very few, and maybe none. Solitude is not patriotic. The fly on the countertop is not there. Buenos Aires, Argentina. At least 60,000 people attended an outdoor Roman Catholic Mass Monday to mourn the theft of former President Juan Perón's hands. Quote, as a result of this luxation of our intellects, the shameful misconception of Marxism could be put about and even believed that economic forces and material interests determine the course of the world. This grotesque overestimation of the economic factor was conditioned by our worship of technological progress, which was itself the fruit of rationalism and utilitarianism after they had killed the mysteries and acquitted man of guilt and sin, but they had forgotten to free him of folly and myopia, and he seemed only fit to mold the world after the pattern of his own banality. Jan Huizinga. For the past 35 years, I've been meaning to find and read a book called The Heart of the Continent by Fitzhugh Ludlow, 1870, wondering if it might be one of those lost classics, which I seem to find more alluring than found ones. He has bought a Madonna by Andrea del Sarto for 600 sequins. It's Goethe, Italian Journey. According to Oscar Wilde, women are sphinxes without secrets. Does he mean that they are simply colossal statues? If so, he is right. Oh, just kidding. Quote, no man who is in a hurry is quite civilized. Will Durant. Is this one way that technology is taking us to new forms of savagery? Some things everyone should know. One, how to swim. Two, how to administer cardiopulmonary resuscitation and the Heimlich maneuver. Three, how to whistle loudly. Four, how to treat kitchen burns and banged parts of the body by immediately applying ice or cold water. I must go back to the Louvre to see an intensely erotic and silly painting called Aurora Encephalus. It's irritating to be almost old without having grown up. A sudden whim to drive 300 miles to Vermont and get new tires. Hearing that Wittgenstein came from the wealthiest family in Austria has made me, for the moment at least, less excited about his ideas. What does that say about me? You are dying for lunch, so you heat up the soup. But now it's too hot to eat. My guilt at not wanting to be buried in Tulsa, as if I were abandoning my mother for eternity. Looking up the words Pyrrhic victory in the dictionary isn't worth the trouble. What to do while a democracy votes itself out of existence? When asked what he wanted done with his body after his death, Philip Whalen said, have them lay me out on a bed of frozen raspberries. A sound enters the room like a cardboard box the size of the room entering the room. On some level, things don't get better or worse, they just get. That I don't know what this means is an example. Whether civilization wants to admit it or not, at this very moment, all over the world, little girls are masturbating. This notebook, I think I bought it in Kiev. I had gone swimming in the Dnieper, mainly because I liked the idea that one day I would be able to tell myself that I had once swam in a river whose name begins with the letters D-N, forgetting that the recent and nearby nuclear power plant disaster at Chernobyl might have rendered the water highly radioactive. Courtesy is more efficient than the lack of it. If I get a fatal disease, I'm going to be very mad at it. I will blame it for my death. It's a quotation. The worth of that is that which it contains, and that is this, and this. Shakespeare, Sonnet 74, almost Gertrude Stein. Does Euclidean geometry say that the angle of reflection is equal to the angle of incidence? If so, it can't be true. The angle of incidence must come first. But if we turn it around, the same problem arises. Geez, only by focusing on such ideas can I avoid raging at the way things are. Theodore equals Theodore. Therefore, Ted Dostoevsky. As the bombs fall in Baghdad tonight, how charming the melodrama of thunder outside my window. Is it snobbery or nostalgia that makes me sad when I think of how it has been decades since I heard the two words that echoed throughout my adolescence, intellectual curiosity? And although one still hears the word conformity, it is no longer a pejorative term. Now we are on the same page, getting with the program, team players. If you live long enough and look hard enough, you will eventually, to your great relief and your great sorrow, find your humanity. A French friend wrote to me, "C'est la fin des carottes," it's the end of the carrots. But I don't know what that means. Maybe that's all she wrote? I sent your saddle home. How could I have bought this notebook in Kiev if the word on its cover, Pikapirochu Shivko, is Finnish? And I'm going to finish. I'm going to conclude with 75 more poems. These are written just not very long ago, a few months. Very post-impressionism. The trouble with listening to this music is that it turns you into a lily pad on a small pond on a rural property not far from Paris, and sitting on you is a large frog named Claude Monet. You want to strangle him, not for his paintings, which are terrible, even for a lily pad, but for the fact that he doesn't know you're there. He thinks you are only a lily pad, and you know that when the music stops, you will be a person again, but by then he will be dead and gone, beyond the reach of your fingers. Hound dog. You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Sounds like an insult. And if it were directed to a person, yes, I would say it is an insult. But if it were directed to a dog, I would say that it is not an insult. It is simply a statement of fact, like telling a rock that it is a rock. Though, of course, since a rock cannot hear the words, it would make less sense to speak to it. Whereas a hound dog could not only hear, but in its own dog way, understand the feeling of the statement via its tone and some other method dogs have of knowing things. For instance, the hound dog would know that if you said such a thing, you would be either a rather daffy ontologist or a shit. But either way, you would fall over sideways if the dog were to answer back, "You ain't nothing but an ontologist," or "You ain't nothing but a shit." Fortunately for you, the hound dog says nothing. It rolls its supposedly sad eyes up to yours and just looks at you. And whether you are an ontologist or a shit, it makes no difference. You ain't nothing. Toothbrush. As the whisk broom is the child of the ordinary broom, which is cousin to the janitor's broom, I am a toothbrush when it comes to bristling. Insufficiently angry, or maybe too angry, to keep my bristles intact, since I know the debris of the world is too great for me to handle. If I could save the world by being crucified, I certainly would. But who would nail a toothbrush to a cross? Rialto. When my mother said, "Let's go down to the Rialto," it never occurred to me that the name Rialto was odd or from anywhere else or meant anything other than Rialto, the movie theater in my hometown, like the Orpheum, whose name was only a phoneme with no trace of the god of poetry, though later I would learn about him and about the bridge, and realize that gods and bridges can fly invisibly across the ocean and change their shapes and land in one's hometown and go on living there until it's time to fly again and start all over as a perfectly clean phoneme in the heads of the innocent and the open on their way to the Ritz. And there are two more poems. Bible study. And they entered the ark, two by two, except for the studs, which were two by four. The hammers and nails got on board too. Everything that existed got on board to go to a new place and build an exact replica of the old place after the flood subsided. And subside it did, so that later a new one could rise again, like the old flood. The new flood would say, ha ha, and the new Noah would say, ho ho. And the last poem, it's called Words from the Front. We don't look as young as we used to, except in dim light, especially in the soft warmth of candlelight, when we say, in all sincerity, you're so cute, and you're my cutie. Imagine two old people behaving like this. It's enough to make you happy. Thank you. Thank you.